Welcome to Faith and Family. I'm Andy Bates. January 3rd, 2017. It's a new year. Lots of great topics lined up for this year. Many in the month of January that will help us take a look at the issues of life with the upcoming March for Life, the LCMS Life Conference, the Liberty Conference for our college students going on this week as well in Washington, D.C. Lots of important topics to discuss this month. And well, we welcome your input as well. If you have questions, comments, something you'd like for us to discuss on Faith and Family, send me an email, family@kfuo.org. Thanks to our underwriter, Concordia University, Wisconsin, for supporting Faith and Family on Worldwide KFUO. Find out more about them on our website, kfuo.org. Look for the CUW logo in the sponsor section. Joining me by phone this morning, Dr. Priscilla Coleman. She's professor of human development and family studies at Bowling Green State University in Bowling Green, Ohio. Dr. Coleman, welcome to Faith and Family.
Thank you, Andy. It's great to be here.
Glad to have some time to chat with you this morning about your work and also what's going on in the world of medical research and scientific research. And you wrote a recent critique on the Journal of the American Medical Association Psychiatry. They had a recent article back in December on a very important topic, research on abortion and mental health. And we're going to get to that in just a little bit. Tell me, though, before we get to that, about your work at Bowling Green State University. You're on break right now, so not a lot of papers to grade right now, and probably enjoying some peace and quiet for the moment.
I'm feeling the time ticking away, but I've been teaching at Bowling Green for 16 years now, and I'm a full professor. I teach classes in development across the lifespan. I teach research methods. I supervise student research projects, and I have a student load of close to 200 students each semester. So once the semester gets rolling, that's pretty much what I'm doing. But I also, as part of my professional responsibilities, I've had to engage in research in order to be tenured and to be promoted to full professor. And my research has been really on all reproductive outcomes. I've studied childbirth and the adjustment to parenting, attachment type issues. I've studied recently, looked at adoption from the birth mother's perspective, but most of my research has been on the psychological implications of abortion. And I've published over 50 journal articles. So I use my summers and the Christmas break to, get ahead with a lot of that. So
what
I
is
don't
it?
Really stop too often.
What is it about this field of human development and family studies that drew you in, that you wanted to study this and to teach this as well?
Oh, sure. Well, actually, my training is all in psychology. I have a PhD in lifespan developmental psychology. I taught in a psych curriculum at the University of the South for 4 years. But human development and family studies is attractive to me and attractive to many people because it is interdisciplinary. We have faculty members who are trained in psych. We've had sociology. We've had social work. It just, the discipline is informed by so many different areas. Mm-hmm. And with the focus really being on how we develop from conception to death, what are all the issues physically, psychologically, socially, and then looking at how families function as a system within a culture across the lifespan as well. And so it's more applied. Psychology is more research-based, and I appreciate the training I received. It was strong in terms of the quantitative, methodological aspects of my work. But I feel more comfortable, I guess, in a human development and family studies program. The people I work with locally and outside of Bowling Green just seem more open-minded or something than psychology. There are a lot of biases that frame the discipline of psychology, and some of that will come out as we discuss this article.
Mm-hmm. So. You mentioned this is really an interdisciplinary program. How does your work shape future thinkers, leaders, and professionals? Who are the professionals that come through this program, and how does your work shape them?
Well, I teach basic courses in development, so the research that I do doesn't necessarily, it informs my teaching to some extent, but my teaching is much broader. then, you know, obviously the focus on pregnancy and abortion and adoption and so forth. But, you know, I try to, you know, I use examples from my work in that way. But I think it's kind of a tough question. I try to be a good role model to students. I try to be available to them on various levels. And all of the courses that I teach, I use the latest research to inform the lectures and so forth. So I think it's hard to really know how we're impacting this generation in the moment. But I often hear from students many years down the road, they appreciated the experience in the classroom and the foundation and research methods if they went on to grad school and so forth. But I think, you know, where I personally am having the most impact in the world relates to the publications and my work as an expert in state and civil cases involving abortion.
How do those publications, especially major medical journals, influence current professionals and future professionals, specifically in those areas of caring professions, psychology, psychiatry?
Well, the textbooks and, you know, all of the professional training, the initial training and the continued education training that professionals receive, it's all based on, or should be based on, journal articles primarily. And obviously practice involves, you know, being, you know, trained in the practical aspects, experience from more, you know, knowledgeable and seasoned professionals. You know, that's part of the training as well. But really the foundation of everything that professionals learn comes from the academic journals across various fields. So we rely on that information, and it needs to be based on solid science. And, you know, so that, you know, and unfortunately, part of that training that individuals receive involves training in research methodology. So if a, you know, a professional in training or someone who's in practice and receives the journal, reads the article, ideally, they have received adequate training in terms of the methods of science so that they can look at that and realize, you know, what the blatant flaws are. And then that, you know, that's likely to cause some significant dissonance, because we're relying on these journals and relying on these textbooks, yet we see such highly flawed research. And so there's got to be another explanation. And the only viable one is that this is, you know, motivated politically. And, you know, so it's scary. It really is.
Right. One of those journals is the Journal of the American Medical Association, also known as JAMA. And particularly JAMA Psychiatry is what we're talking about today. There was an article in the December 14th, titled "Women's Mental Health and Well-Being 5 Years After Being Denied an Abortion, a Prospective Longitudinal Cohort Study."
Now, right.
How you wrote a critique of this and stated, "Our culture is in a worrisome state when major medical journals ignore the foundation and methods of science in service to a political end." How so? Can you elaborate on that?
Yes, well, it is scary if a political agenda is more important than providing the information we need to provide quality health care. We wouldn't want anybody performing heart surgery on us or prescribing medications that are based on faulty science. I mean, that's exactly what's happening here, because this journal is highly respected throughout the world. People will just look at the bottom line results. Professionals, clinicians are busy people, and they don't always have time to, you know, read through the sampling and all of the issues that may be present there to form their own opinion. They rely on those journal editors to have scrutinized the methodology and to only publish research that's credible with valid findings. And so, I've lost faith in these professional organizations that allow journals to get away with this stuff. And so, you know, that's what's scary about it. We're performing healthcare based on studies that are not science, simply not science.
How does this particular study, this article that written about this study, how does it approach the practice of abortion. The topic is women's mental health and well-being 5 years after being denied an abortion. How does it approach the topic or the practice of abortion in the United States?
Okay, well, I can kind of explain to you what they did. And there were admirable features. The fact that they followed women for 5 years, that's great. We have very few what we call prospective or longitudinal studies. The problem with their study is they lost like over three quarters of the sample, so that invalidated their conclusions. But just to back up a little bit, exactly what they did is they compared women relative to anxiety, depression, self-esteem, and life satisfaction. Women who had a first trimester abortion were compared with those that had an abortion just before the legal limit in the particular state, and those women who had were denied an abortion because they just missed that legal limit. And then those women either went on to give birth, or they may have had an abortion somewhere else or a miscarriage. So based on comparisons of those three groups, they concluded that those who were denied abortions had the poorest outcomes 1 week later. And what does 1 week later really mean? You know, they were denied what they were thinking they needed to have done at the moment, and they're probably still in crisis. But, you know, that was basically their results. When we conduct a study, we can't sample everyone in the population. Typically, there are some population-based studies, but there usually isn't, you know, and we don't have the resources, practical resources or financial to sample everyone in a country or everyone who's had an abortion. So what we do is we select a group from that population, and that's the sample. And the degree to which that sample represents the population is the foundation of any conclusions that we're able to draw. And the biggest issue with this study is it in no way represented women who typically have abortions. So I can kind of just go through what some of the big issues were. What I mentioned earlier was they initially asked lots of women to participate. Only 37.5 of those that were asked, you know, agreed to participate, and then they lost 42% throughout the study. So they were basically down to 22% of the original sample, and that 22%, those women were the ones they based their conclusions on. They also paid them, so the ones that stayed in the study received $350. That's considered kind of unethical because poor women will be unable to say no, so there's a coercive element there, and you're likely to get a biased sample if you're paying as well. They may be women who have more conflicted lives, difficulties on various levels if they're kind of desperate for that money. They made a statement in their conclusions indicating that the sample represented women who have an abortion. Well, demographically, if you just look at what, you know, the demographics, they, in their sample, it was 32% white, 32% black, and 36% mixed or other. And that compares to nationally in the U.S., 51% of the abortions are performed on white women, 41% on black, and 9% other. So it really doesn't even approximate women who have had abortions. So, and then another glaring problem with this study, huge, was how they measured anxiety and depression. Both of those outcomes were assessed with only six items, and there are all kinds of well-validated, stronger instruments with, you know, multiple you know, variables related to the different disorders. And it's six items really doesn't tell you anything. That's just not good science. And then when they also looked at self-esteem and life satisfaction with one single item. There isn't another topic in all of psychology or medicine that you could get a study published with such simplistic, superficial assessments. And they were so highly funded. It's ridiculous. I mean, it doesn't make any sense that they didn't have better measures.
So basically,
and then another.
So what you're saying is that their assessment of life satisfaction or even depression was really based on just one question per topic?
Yeah, correct.
Are you depressed? I mean, it was something right. Like, I don't know what the actual question was.
Yeah,
but
no real clinical assessments here. And yet the headlines in newspapers across the country, across the world said abortion is not linked with mental health problems. Hello. And we really don't ever in science conclude anything based on one study because there are so many different variables or different, aspects of the sample that, another study may show a lack of support for a hypothesis. I'm always telling my students, don't even use the word prove because it doesn't prove anything. We provide support for a theory, for a hypothesis. And if we look at all of the literature on abortion and mental health, it overwhelmingly indicates that abortion significantly increases women's risk for having mental health problems. But we don't say it causes mental health problems. In some individual cases, it surely did cause the mental health problems. But the way that we measure these kinds of psychological variables, we just can't be that definitive because we can't manipulate somebody's reproductive history. We can't assign women to have an abortion or to have a birth. And the only way in science that we can really make those causal conclusions in a given study is when we randomly assign to conditions and then we follow the outcomes. And so, I testify in court all the time that the evidence indicates that women are at an increased risk and they deserve to be provided counseling and particularly when we have a whole other body of research indicating which women are most likely to have adverse consequences. We know that if they're having decisional distress, if they're ambivalent, if they're being pressured from others, if they feel that connection to the baby, if the pregnancy is more advanced, if they have prior mental health problems, if they believe the fetus is human, and 50% do, if they've had prior traumas. So we know so much about the risk factors. It's all in these journals throughout the world. And so, women need to be counseled effectively and substantively. Do they fall into a high-risk group? And then they need to be told that if they undergo the abortion, they may be looking at depression, suicide, ideation or actual suicide attempts. I was on a case in New Jersey with the young woman hung herself in her room after an abortion. And she was, she received the abortion through the Stephen Brigham's clinics in New Jersey. And she was told, part of my job was to evaluate the information that Stacy was provided and compare that to what was known in 2002. And she was in that fact sheet, they called it. She was literally told that it's common for women to have many abortions, some having over 20 abortions. This poor girl was told that by a supposed counselor and told that women who have abortions experience a sense of happiness and new hope and all these positive undocumented outcomes. And there literally is, virtually no study documenting positive effects of abortion. And there are hundreds of studies showing that abortion negatively influences women. And it's not just their mental health. It affects relationships. It affects parenting. The problems are just systemic.
How would you describe the methodological approach of this research in this article compared to the standards that other research
should uphold?
Yes, right.
Well, you do want to have initial initial decision to participate to be high. You know, you want to, if you ask a group of people, will they be in your study, you want to make sure at least 70 or 80% agree. Otherwise, you're getting a group that is maybe nicer, more likely to volunteer, may have more time, so they're going to be less representative of the population. So you want high initial consent to participate rates. You want to retain your sample. If you're losing more than, you know, if you're losing more than probably 20%, you're going to have skewed results. So that initial consent to participate, continuing involvement in the study to the end, substantive measures. You want the samples to be large enough. It's impossible to be representative if you have a small sample. In 2011, I published a meta-analysis in the British Journal of Psychiatry, which is one of the top journals in the world for psychiatry as well. It was amazing. They published my politically incorrect findings. But basically, in a meta-analysis, what you do, and it's considered a higher level of evidence than a single study, because I integrated information from 22 existing studies, and then from that data identified a summary effect. And so basically, this meta-analysis pulled information from almost 900,000 women, and I found that women who have an abortion compared to those who don't have an 81% increased risk for mental health problems. And so that study I use a lot in court when I do expert work, because it does trump a single study. It's information from 22 studies, and the larger studies are given more weight in the analysis. And I had inclusion criteria. I didn't incorporate any studies that had glaring methodological problems, and I made sure that I only used those that had 100 or more participants and studies that had controls for other kinds of variables, because you don't want to be comparing women who undergo an abortion at 19 to are 15 or any age to women who are, you know, delivering a wanted plan for baby, because their life situations are too different. And so when you see differences in the outcomes, we don't have confidence that it was the abortion per se. It could have been other things. It could have been abuse in the relationship. And so it is important to control for other demographic and situational variables. And so I only included studies that had those kinds of controls. And so, you know, all studies are not created equal, I guess, is sure. The bottom line. And now we know from this study and many others that have been published that the impact factor or the prestige of the journal doesn't mean a whole lot if the editors are motivated to only publish findings that will, fortify an agenda.
We only have about just about a minute and a half, 2 minutes left. You conclude your critique with, the studies will be unattended by the average person, clinicians and science savvy alike, because the results simply do not align with the lived experiences of women. With just about a minute to elaborate on that.
Okay. Well, their claims are counter to what people in our culture are becoming increasingly aware of, and that's that millions of women are suffering in the aftermath of abortion. We do see those effects throughout the fabric of society. We see it in the parenting problems. We see it in substance abuse. We see it in relationship problems. And an abortion involves ending the life of a human being, and there are effects of that. It's not like getting your tooth pulled or any other simple, fast, elective surgery. It involves two human beings, and most women know that. They know that on some level, and it may not impact them in the immediate. It may impact them later when they have a child down the road. But there are so many testimonies. So many women are, you know, bravely coming forward and sharing the impact. It can't be squashed. You know, there's just been too much hurt, too much harm. The numbers are down. So we're down to under 1 million abortions each year. But at one point, it was 1.6 million abortions every year. All those women, year after year, they have families, they have friends. They, you know, so it's, we can't the truth is that abortion is not easy for many, many women. And that's a truth that no matter what the professional organizations, you know, try to do here and the journals, it can't be squashed anymore. It can't be hidden. It needs to be dealt with.
So certainly something to be mindful of as we hear about these studies in mainstream media. Don't just take it for what you hear on the cover of this story, but actually dig a little deeper and find out, is that research really accurate? Did it follow all the proper steps? What was their approach to
right.
it? Dr. Priscilla Coleman, Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at Bowling Green State University, Bowling Green, Ohio. Dr. Coleman, thank you for being my guest today on Faith and Family.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Coming up in just a little bit, we'll revisit a conversation with Dr. Michelle Cortella, President of the American College of Pediatricians, the effects of pornography, particularly on children. You're listening to Faith and Family on Worldwide KFUO.
Concordia University, Wisconsin in Mequon overlooks a half mile of beautiful Lake Michigan shoreline. CUW campus is located 15 miles north of Milwaukee, with over 70 undergraduate majors, 28 graduate degree programs, and doctorate programs in pharmacy, physical therapy, occupational therapy, and nursing practice. CUW offers online learning and accelerated learning at one of 9 Wisconsin centers and one in St. Louis. Traditional or accelerated education, CUW has the program for you. CUW.edu.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, president of Life Issues Institute.
The people of Colorado recently legalized physician-assisted suicide. In the event you think this is a good thing, let me show you what it's leading to in other countries. The Netherlands moved from assisted death to euthanasia. Then they progressed to killing patients who were not only terminal, but depressed. Now they kill infants suffering from things as minor as Down syndrome. Most recently, they've begun to euthanize alcoholics. Mark was an alcoholic for 8 years when he asked for and received euthanasia. It's logical to assume drug addicts are next. This is what happens when society decides innocent human life is no longer sacred. The so-called safeguards fall by the wayside and abuses multiply like rabbits. No crystal ball required. Just look at the history of the world.
Follow us on Twitter at Life Issues USA and stay informed, more informed than you've ever been.
Do you want a simple and convenient way of making gifts to KFUO? A donor-advised fund may be the solution. A donor-advised fund allows you to choose the timing and amounts of your gifts to KFUO along with making gifts to other ministries. If you have questions about donor-advised funds or other planned gifts, call Mary at 314-996-1518. We'll send a representative out to help answer your questions. That's 314-996-1518.
Listen to Worldwide KFUO a click away 24 hours a day at KFUO.org. With our KFUO website and smartphone apps, you can listen to our live stream and our on-demand programs and podcasts anytime, day or night. Listen to Worldwide KFUO when you're available and where you are. Listen on your car radio, Bluetooth devices, smartphones, podcast players, Wi-Fi radios, and so many other listening devices. Listen today, tonight, tomorrow, whenever. And tell your friends about KFUO a click away 24 hours a day at KFUO.org.
You used to change my diapers.
Take care of me 24 hours a day.
Send me to school.
Mom.
Dad, I need you.
There's all these things I'm feeling that I've never felt before.
I need to know about having a boyfriend.
I need you to set limits.
I need you to tell me where you stand.
Help me make the right choices.
Mom, Dad, talk with me. You always say I can talk to you about anything.
A message from the Missouri Department of Health and Senior Services.
Since 1973, citizens of the United States of America have murdered 55 million people. How? Abortion. What are you going to do about it? This January 2017, thousands are going to march for life. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod Life 360 Conference will be taking place in, with, and under this most necessary event. Find out more at lcms.org/life. My name is Pastor Jonathan Fisk, and I'm going to be there. Will you?
Join Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service and congregations across the country as we celebrate Refugee Sunday, a time to lift up the gifts that migrants and refugees bring to our country and to reflect on Christ's message to welcome the stranger. Together, we can continue the mission of welcoming, embracing, and empowering newcomers. Visit LIRS.org/kit to download the Refugee Sunday Kit for your congregations, including worship guides, bulletin inserts, videos, and more. LIRS.org/kit.
Today's presentation is an encore presentation. Any dates or events mentioned in the program have already occurred. Well, welcome back to Faith and Family, Dr. Michelle Critella. It's good to have a chance to talk with you today and learn more about what's going on with the American College of Pediatricians today.
Oh, thank you so much, Andy. It's always a pleasure to be here on your program.
Tell us I know that the college has a statement on pornography and children. We're going to talk about that in just a little bit. Any other news from the American College of Pediatricians today?
We're happy to report that we are growing, and we're increasingly being able to work with like-minded organizations, including a national pro-life organization of obstetrician and gynecologists. Mm-hmm. In fact, we will be having a joint medical education conference in Houston, Texas in February that we're very excited about. So we're hoping that this bodes well for an increasing number of pro-life pediatricians and other primary care physicians.
Mm-hmm.
So that's our good professional news. And we have also been able to increase our outreach to parents and families through our blogs, because we have hired some marriage and family graduate students in marriage and family counseling who are blogging on a variety of common mm-hmm. topics and issues of interest to mothers and fathers. So we're happy.
I've noticed the increase of posts on there recently. So, well, thanks for doing that.
Yeah, you're welcome. And thanks for spreading the word.
Glad to do it. Well, today the topic we're addressing is pornography and children, the effects that pornography has on children, and I know the college has released a statement about that. Before we went on the air, you were explaining how sometimes when a statement is released, it's very structured and very specific language, kind of technical language. Today we'll talk about that statement, but I'll also talk about it in layman's terms as well. And I appreciate that you always do a fine job of helping us work through these issues as parents and grandparents and care providers would want to understand.
Right, exactly. I mean, if people are, obviously it's a public statement, so anyone could go to our website and look at it. So our specific position statements often have a number of statistics, which a mother and father may not find very practical or useful, mm-hmm. but a graduate student or policymaker may need. So certainly on programs like this, I want to make it, really just break it down and get to the bottom line and make it very usable to families.
Well, what are some of the key things that parents or care providers, educators need to know about pornography and its effects on children?
Sure. Well, I think the first thing we all need to realize, because even myself as a parent, one of the first things that really surprised me was how pervasive pornography is first among adults, even Christian adults. In some surveys, over half to 70% of even Christian men are involved or addicted to pornography, depending on where those surveys, you know, are taken, the different populations. So I think as parents and educators and adults in general, we have to realize that first we have to take an inventory of our own lives. And if we need help, if we have this problem and addiction to pornography, we need to get ourselves help first if we want to hope to impact our children in the right way. The reason the college decided that we really need to get a statement out on the issue of pornography in children is because we're seeing these same elevated percentages, up to 70% of teen boys surveyed think there's no problem with pornography, that it's a fine thing to view and engage in. And nearly 50% of girls in some surveys are finding the same opinion of the same opinion. And the problems, pornography becomes addictive just as drugs, alcohol, and smoking. So we need to get that word out to our young people so that they're aware that this is not a harmless thing.
What is some of the harm that is brought about by pornography? How does pornography, well, let's talk about boys. We'll talk about girls as well.
Sure.
Particularly
yeah.
boys, you know, when are we seeing, at what age are we seeing boys first exposed to pornography?
That's really a good question, because this is another, can be shocking, but even as young as 10. And the primary reason is technology. Now, especially with smartphones being given to elementary school students, you know, porn sites are just a click away, and it's most frequently in the young kids, most frequently happening by accident, that they're coming upon these. And whether accidental exposure or, you know, an older sibling or older friend leading them to the sites on purpose, it can be quite shocking to these young children. Confusion, anxiety, and depression are all mental side effects of being exposed to pornography that young. And even in teenagers who think it's no big deal, when these, particularly the boys, when they are evaluated, yes, they have depression and anxiety related to their porn usage. And just like being addicted to drugs and alcohol, porn use is associated with poor performance in school as well. We have to start thinking about pornography the same way we do drugs and alcohol when it comes to kids.
What about girls and exposure to pornography?
Sure. With the girls, I think the biggest harm there is to their self-image and self-esteem, because they're taking the pornography in, and it's giving a horrible message, the message that girls are valued only for their bodies and only for how well they can sexually satisfy men. This notion that a relationship is healthy even when it involves verbal abuse, physical abuse, or sexual abuse, because all of these things are contained in within the porn. It's a very dangerous message for girls to absorb, and it's equally dangerous for the boys to have. We're setting them up for horrible relationships.
How does pornography distort a young person's view of self-worth and sexuality?
Right. Well, and I think this is the same for the boys as the girls. It's reducing sexuality to purely to a physical pleasure, to a taking versus, you know, particularly from, and I say this whether it's a Christian audience or a secular audience, sexual intercourse is supposed to be a gift, and particularly from the Christian worldview, your sexuality is the gift of your entire self. And even a secular or audience can understand that it's not just skin to skin. You are opening your emotional life, your mental, your physical. It's everything. It's all of you, and this is supposed to be something beautiful. That message is not there within pornography at all. So it gives a very abusive portrayal of sexuality, which is dangerous for boys as well as girls. I don't know if you'd like. I can share some of the survey results in terms of how boys who are invested in pornography, how they view girls.
Sure. Well, as best we can do without it.
Right.
Sure.
But essentially, we do know that boys, meaning teen boys, as well as older men, so they kind of follow the same pattern, they are far more likely to be accepting of sexual promiscuity, mm-hmm. of non-consensual sex. So again, the abuse, the acceptance of abuse and violence within relationships, they find that less problematic than, say, men who are not involved in porn. So this is not just a theoretical concern. It actually happens. You know, having a steady diet of pornography that degrades sexuality in that way desensitizes mm-hmm. boys and men, and they start to act it out in their relationships.
So regular, as you said, regular use of pornography then shapes their worldview, their understanding of what sexuality is, and even what healthy sexuality is.
That's right.
And their self-worth, the worth of others, and in doing so really devalues both people and the gift as well.
Right. And then when this goes forward, should they eventually, they value... boys and men who have been using porn also, when surveyed, value marriage less.
Mm-hmm.
And when they do get married, are also less committed to that relationship. And there's certainly plenty of studies that have demonstrated pornography is a cause for divorce between couples.
Let's talk about addiction and how this becomes an addiction. You mentioned earlier that this can become an addiction, much like an addiction to drugs or alcohol.
Yes. Anytime we experience a new experience or something exciting,
mm-hmm.
pleasurable, there is a release of neurochemicals mm-hmm. in the brain to reinforce that reinforces that. And the same neurochemicals released when, let's say, a person is drinking alcohol or high on drugs, that same chemical, those same neurochemicals are released with exposure to porn. Excuse me. So at the physiological and the biological level, there are changes going on in the person's brain, which makes it very, very difficult to break the habit, which is why within our position statement and on our website, we do list a number of different groups that can help individuals and families
mm-hmm.
who struggle with this problem. Certainly, we want prevention, and so there's a number of filters and so forth that parents can use to decrease the risk of any inappropriate material coming through their computers. So prevention and treatment are key. It's we tend to look at it as a moral problem, and it certainly is, but we have to be careful to realize, okay, this is also a biological and psychological phenomenon going on, and so we have to look at all avenues of help, the spiritual, the spiritual and the medical avenues of help.
Sure, it affects the whole person.
Correct.
In numerous ways. And so what I'm hearing you say is that it not only affects in one aspect of life, but in several aspects of
yeah.
life, which then shapes relationships, family, and then ultimately society as
absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What can parents do then if they, if they suspect that a child has been exposed to pornography, or if they suspect that their adolescent, their teen, or maybe, heaven help us, even younger, may have an addiction to pornography?
Right. The key is with any, with in terms of any issue going through a child's lifespan is to hopefully the parents have made open communication. Something as simple, and I think we talked about this in a previous program, something as simple as the family table. If you as parents and children are in regular communication, sharing these daily events and also have consistently been acknowledging your child's feelings as they grow up, when you notice something odd, like, oh, Joe's spending an awful lot more time, he's withdrawn, he's kind of spending hours alone with his iPad or computer, and something doesn't feel quite right to you,
mm-hmm.
then you want to be careful. Obviously, you don't want to go up in an accusatory way, but you can express concern. You know, gee, Joe, I know. You know, Dad and I have noticed some changes in you, X, Y, Z. Is everything okay? Can we talk? So I think you want to start with open-ended questions, and then see how your child responds, and. And then you can actually bring up something, you know, specific. You know, what have you been doing on your computer? You know, pornography is all over the place now. Lots of kids see it and use it. Is this something that you've come across, that you've been doing? So as much as possible, parents may be able to broach it on their own in that fashion. If parents feel uncomfortable or they try that route first and it doesn't go so well, by all means, talk with you can give your child's pediatrician a call,
mm-hmm.
and it may be a topic that could first be broached together with the pediatrician and the parent in the room together. Prevention is always the best way. So starting early and young and trying to, particularly as Christians, promoting the virtues of modesty and chastity throughout the life, you know, throughout their growth and development, it's going to make talking about these issues easier as they come up.
Sure. And We've talked on here on Faith and Family before about placing technology in the hands of children. It's
right.
The culture that we live in, the world that we live in. Mm-hmm. It's just simply a fact that the children are always mm-hmm. going to be exposed to technology and access to the internet, whether it's at home or in the future as even in their career down the road, they're probably going to be using technology,
right.
Even if they don't have access to it at home. But so many schools use technology today that it's just a part of our culture. It's embedded in our culture and society today. It's something that we're going to be using, I'm sure, for a long time.
Oh, absolutely. We do, at the college, or if I have a parent talking with me,
mm-hmm.
I will encourage them. It's true, you can't keep them away from all technology.
Sure.
But do what you can to control what happens in your own home.
Right.
and certainly by, I also cannot emphasize enough how important it is to know their friends and to know the parents of their friends and to have open conversations with the friend's parents, and you can get an idea of what goes on, you know, in their home too. I frequently, as much as I can, have my kids invite their friends over to our place, mm-hmm. and they hang out here, and they, you know, have some good, clean fun.
And your house is the cool house to hang out
at. That's what you try to... Yeah, you try. You know, I find parent networking is huge. It doesn't take a lot. It can take just two or three, and we share. We will rotate a pizza night, mm-hmm. so that no one family bears the cost or the burden of cooking or whatnot. But simple things like that to keep your children engaged with like-minded friends, and it keeps you engaged with your kids too. It's probably the most important factor. The parent-child connectedness across mm-hmm. the board is the most important factor when you're talking about any sort of social or psychological problems that kids can encounter today.
And so we're not going to avoid technology, but we are going to be proactive about how it's used in our home and knowledgeable right. of how it's used in our, you know, our children's friends' homes and our friends' yes. homes and other family members' homes as well.
That's right. Exactly.
I mean, even something as simple as this is something my wife and I have become sensitive to, is what's playing on TV, because, you know, many homes you go into today in North America, the TV's playing in the background. We treat TV almost like we have treated radio in the past, and that is, you know, we have it going in the background passively. We're not necessarily listening to it intently, but it's always running in the background. There's always something playing in the background, or maybe we're watching it, but we're also doing, you know, five other things at the same time.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
And what's on that TV, though, is the question. What programs are broadcasting or throughout our home on that TV, or throughout the grandma and grandpa's house, or you know, aunt and uncle's house, or friend's home, or the neighbor's home, and what's going on in the background? With a 2-year-old, we've been a lot more mindful of what kind of programs that might be okay for a 12-year-old to yeah. watch, as parents have conversations with them and can understand those things and deal with them appropriately, but some right. things might be a little too scary for a 2-year-old.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And that's, our recommendations, we encourage families early on, I don't talk about it at the prenatal visit, but
sure.
but once the baby has arrived, I do talk to parents about mm-hmm. Trying to keep that switch over to the radio, but keeping that TV off except for selected programs.
Sure.
And preferably just to keep TV and computer screens away from kids, certainly before the age of two. And they'll say, well, what about baby Einstein? And I'll say, you know what? Never been proven to help kids. Babies, especially, they need people contact. They need to gaze into the eyes of their moms and dads. They need human interaction. Screens cannot, there's no age, mm-hmm. absolutely no age or developmental stage in which a screen can replace human contact.
Good point. Good point. Yeah. And that brings us back to the very topic of you know, pornography and its effect on children as well, and how it shapes and distorts our views. Well, certainly an important topic. I want to point our listeners to your website as well, bestforchildren.org. That's the American College of Pediatricians website. They can find more information, helpful resources there as well. Dr. Cretella, always great to have time to talk with you about these important topics, and I appreciate the statements that the college releases, and I certainly appreciate your time sharing this with us today.
Thank you so much, Andy. Thank you for this opportunity. Our goal at the college is to really to strengthen families, first and foremost, strengthen families. And in that way, we're going to improve society.
Well, thanks so much for your time today.
Listen to Faith and Family Monday through Friday at this time. Faith and Family is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for Faith and Family to continue. Our address is 1333 South Kirkwood Road, St. Louis, Missouri, 63122. You can contact us on the web and download Faith and Family at KFUO.org. Worldwide KFUO, on the air, online, and on demand.